Well, good afternoon. I want to commend you guys. I think this kind of a session is always a really good idea, and I commend you guys for being here. You had many choices of where you would be in this hour and a half. Some of your colleagues chose content, and you cleverly chose content about your careers, so good for you. It was really interesting to listen to my colleagues on the panel talk. I think the instructions to us were probably deliberately a little bit ambiguous. We've all taken a somewhat different approach on this. I think Dr. Berlin gave you a really nice overview of opportunities within cancer institute research, especially focused on disparities and the multiple methods. And we all envy what NIH has in terms of a career ladder. So I think that's going to be a great resource for you. Dr. Cahill was describing what I think is just one of the most exciting new areas for public health, LGBT, and it was fun for me to hear some of the development in the early phases of a new area getting carved out. I was reminiscing about when disability was sort of in some of those places, not that we're that much farther along. Dr. Hudson really shared some real personal perspectives and his advice based on, I think, a number of years probably of mentoring students through making career choices. So you've had sort of a full array. And with me, you're probably going to get sort of a smattering of all of that. At first, I want to acknowledge that October is Disability Employment Awareness Month. So if folks did not know that, this is the month when we try to bring attention to the importance of employment of people with disabilities. I'm going to try to do... and this is the standard disclosure slide that every federal employee in essence needs to use, which is to say that what I'm going to say is not the responsibility or the perspective of the federal government, and instead I am proceeding at my own peril, like the guys in the bikes. I was, in fact, asked to speak on information on current research and then advice for career development and in essence on physical disabilities, but I'm going to go beyond that to speak about an array of disabilities, and I'm going to give sort of a smattering in terms of current research because I could have taken that in several ways. But what I want to start with is just a quick overview of because disability and public health is also a relatively new field, and there has been some people are becoming increasing their understanding of what this involves. I want to tell you what a disability is, and it really is, it's a limitation in functioning, and that's really what it is. And it could be limitation in thinking, in moving, in seeing, in hearing, or behavioral and emotional control. So we often talk about that as cognitive, mobility, vision, hearing, or mental health disorders. And people who have some limitation of functioning in one of those areas all comes under the general category of disability. There are many causes of disability. People are born with disabilities like autism or cerebral palsy. People acquire them as a result of injury, like a spinal cord injury. You can acquire them on the basis of chronic conditions, lose a leg, post-diabetes, you can have a stroke at some point in your life, and then what we do know is that increasingly as people age, the prevalence of disability increases, but the majority of people with disabilities are under age 65. So just for you to know, it's a very broad spectrum of people who are included. It is up to 20%, or 1 in 5 of people in this country will self-report as having that kind of a limitation. And as I said, it increases with age, but that the majority of people are under age 65. What it is not an indication of poor health. It does not have to mean poor health, although many people live with poor health, and we believe preventable poor health. It is not poor quality of life, which has been an interesting phenomenon. In fact, that was called the disability paradox in a paper that came out in 1999. Sort of like people living with very significant limitations and still reporting, you know, my life is really pretty good. I'm pretty happy with where my life is going. And disability, as the World Health Organization has now started to frame it, is not specific to a person. People do have limitations, but the disability itself really is interaction with your environment. If your environment helps or hinders you, that is part a contributor to what's really a disabling process. So for the and that opens up many opportunities within public health. Disability and public health is very much a new and a growing field. And we're certainly seeing increased attention. At one point, it was one of the fastest growing sections next to health IT within APHA, and certainly starting to see a lot of excitement at APHA because of some what we think of as really breakthroughs finally starting to happen. We really think about disability across the lifespan and actually across the life course. I know I've talked about different ages where you can acquire disability. Once acquired, you typically live with it for the rest of your life. And what happens early on in your life really does have many implications for what happens later in your life. And that's a life course model. So disability gives an opportunity to think about life from that perspective. And increasingly, we have been pressing that disability is a health disparity population, which means that we think that there are that people are experiencing poorer health than they necessarily need to, and that there is a role for public health to address that. In terms of research opportunities, there are many opportunities and there are numerous employers. This applies to all types of public health research, but certainly the federal agencies, and you've got at least two representatives on the panel today, are major employers of real researchers, not fake researchers, of real researchers. Now, people who really do get to conduct their own research, not only as a project officer, although sometimes in that capacity, you also get to frame an issue, and how you let out the funding opportunity announcements really helps shape a field. Research activities happen at universities. They also happen within state public health departments to some extent. Much of that is more applied or community-based. And what I didn't put up are some of the for-profit and not-for-profit research organizations that largely bid for large federal or foundation grants. In terms of the research opportunities in disability and health, so here I am, I'm making a shameless plug, but I think for me, this has been a really rich and productive career for research. And last summer, I was part of a panel with an international group on intellectual disabilities, and a member of the audience asked a Dutch colleague, how did she attract people to the intellectual disability research and provision of medical services for people with intellectual disabilities? Isn't that sort of the lowest on the totem pole? And she could respond with such honesty and candor to say, if you want to have a career that is intriguing every day of your life, this is the career for you. And that's what she tells her students, that there isn't an issue or a question that somebody else encounters in their own field that hasn't come up in her field, whether it's how do you deal with people whom you have real difficulty communicating with, how do you deal with complex interactions of multiple conditions, how do you deal with social systems in order to make some systemic change. All of those can come up in disability research. So from my perspective and my Dutch colleague, there are enough questions for a full career for all of us. Let me just flash up as an enticement one of the findings that's been out for at least a decade. And you may know that a very popular question on many public health surveys, it is a single self-rated health question. Overall, how would you rate your health? Is it excellent, very good, good, fair, or poor? And you respond to that. And people who respond fair or poor, we really have concerns about what's going on for that person or those populations. Good, very good, and excellent is sometimes lumped as the good health group. This slide shows that people who report having a disability are four times more likely to report their health being fair or poor. In 2006, that was at 38.7% reported their health to be fair or poor, and in 2010, that had gone up to 39.5%. Now, you'll see that the comparison of people without disabilities at 9.5% and then going down actually to 8.7%, this is where you see this fourfold gap, and you see the disparity actually increasing between these two groups. Now, that's sort of a very fundamental observation, and as I said, we've had that finding out for at least a decade. The next series of questions really relates to. So what's going on with this? Why is this group of people, this large group of people, and for a while we didn't have better data as to who might be reporting this, why is their health so bad? I'm not going to get into all of the answers to that. You're going to have to come to the sequel of this movie to hear all of that. But there really are many ways of peeling this onion in order to understand what's going on and then where are the opportunities for public health intervention. I don't think I'd do anything more. Nope. So here are some of the questions you might come up with. So what are the social determinants that contribute to poor health? Or how does poor health develop over the life course? Was it always poor? Did it get dramatically poor at some point? What are the interventions? Most of us are pretty focused on trying to make a difference. What are the interventions that are effective to prevent or improve poor health? And that would be just round number one. I would also be wondering, so which among these people? Are there some other parameters we can look at? How are we measuring poor health? What does that all mean? In terms of career development, you've probably heard from the rest of the panel, there really are many points of entry, and depending on where you are at your educational level, you probably know whether for you it's good to go out and get some more experience at this point, or for you whether it's good now to move on to getting a graduate or a terminal degree, or where you want to go with your career at this point. There are obviously career tracks around research, career tracks around programs and interventions, tracks around policy, and importantly, tracks on health communication. That's an area that I was less familiar with until I joined the federal government and have just really grown to respect how important health messaging is, how we get the word out. You can work at the local level. We were hearing some great descriptions of community-based participatory research. You can work state or nationally. You can work globally, and many students are also doing international work. And I put up here, we are in process of working with an expert panel to develop some core competencies in disability and public health. This has been an area that's been growing for a while. First textbook came out in 2009, and so this expert panel group has been outlining what some of those core competencies that anybody working in public health who works with disabilities ought to know. And from my perspective, everybody should be working with disabilities, whether you're going into obesity research, whether you're going to smoking research, you're going to find that there's a higher prevalence of disability populations in almost every one of these areas. So you do need to know more about who that, in the case of smoking and obesity, who that 30% of your target population really is. So let me speak just very briefly to career opportunities at CDC, and this is where these would be opportunities for anybody with an interest in any of the areas might have an opportunity for a fellowship at CDC, and they're at different kinds of levels. Some people can come in. I think there might be some at a bachelor's level, certainly master's and doctoral levels. And that website, cdc.gov fellowships index, is a good resource just to go and snoop around, see if there's something that really catches your fancy. So there are student internships and fellowships. We almost always have students and fellows rotating through. There are career training fellowships. There are postdoctoral research fellowships and minority health workforce internship opportunities. Now let me shift to a different part. So if you are a person with a disability, there are programs really targeted. The HHS, for example, has a target to have at least 2% of the workforce have what's called a targeted disability. That's a list, and that's a fairly significant disability. CDC, I think, for this year or last year, upped that to said we want to go to 2.5%, so we've got some active activity in that. I just made a commitment that our program would start an internship for people with disabilities who are wanting to get a break into the workforce. So if you are a person with a disability, there are some ways of streamlining hiring into the federal government. That's called a Schedule A. And if you go to that www.cdc.gov employment, that will give you some broad information. And then look for the button that asks for job seekers with disability. And then one more website on federal employment of people with disabilities. So lots of opportunities to check out, explore. As I said, this is Disability Employment Awareness Month. This is the poster that CDC put together, and just as it seemed like a nice closing to say, a strong workforce is an inclusive workforce. So thank you very much.
So now I want to open it up to anybody that has any questions. Michelle.
Well, I hope not. I think you have to stay balanced and not. When I was in graduate school, I said to myself, when I was what you were describing, just dealing with many papers to read and chapters to read and being prepared for class and things like that, I said, and request to work with people and do research and things like that, and you're trying to balance everything. I said to myself then, I refuse to be overwhelmed. And so I still say that to myself now, where I try to keep myself balanced and make sure that I have fun and have outlets and reward myself, but still get things done. So I enjoy what I do every day, though. So I think that's something that you have to make sure that from the baseline, it's something that you want to be doing. And every day I get up and I enjoy what I do. So it feels good to me. So I hope it's, if it's bad now, hopefully it'll be uphill from here.
Yeah, I would agree. I think before going into federal government, I've done academia, I've done corporate and now federal. And so even when teaching, and I still teach and mentor doctoral students, chair dissertation committees now. And so I really think it's you choosing, you're choosing. I just never forget when I actually went through interviews, not only for my PhD program, but also for professorship positions afterwards, I really observed how people seemed to be interacting and how they were, you know, if they appeared. I know it was a short time, but like if they were happy, you know, how many people in the department were married and just different things like that. I really looked at, because I was determined that I wouldn't be this miserable, tucked away person doing research, but that I would have a balanced life and engage and have time for, you know, my family and to do things outside of the academy. And so I do. I think you have to make a choice. There are times that you're going to be hitting the grind, but I think that's in any, you know, whether you're corporate, academia, or, you know, if you're in the federal government, I think you have to choose that, you know, I'm determined to have work-life balance, you know. And so sometimes you can get the balance better, and then sometimes there's challenges. But I think overall it's choosing to just to be determined. I'm going to have a balanced life.
Can you hear in the back okay?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'm going to be a little contrarian then to say, I think it was tough early on. And part of it, I think, was figuring out enough focus and efficiency. If I, you know, my first 5 years is so far back now that I have historical perspective on it. But I think that I worked real hard, but it wasn't always as efficient or productive. Mm-hmm. I think now I make better choices about, I'll give that attention, but I'm not going to pour my soul into it. This I really will, because this is what will feed my either it's an important step into something else, or it really feeds me. And I don't think that I was as confident about knowing when to prioritize work hard here, do okay, but don't work hard there. So I think I got better with that. And I was probably of an earlier, I hate to say this, an earlier generation where I was still part of the cadre of women mm-hmm. who was still having to prove, mm-hmm. You know, doing the 150%, or we felt like we did, in order to be taken seriously. So I think I'm hopeful that has changed.
Moved in different areas across my career. I did a lot of work on children and infants for a period of time. I worked clinically for a period of time. I was teaching. I don't regret any of that stuff. I think that where I wound up, I would have been more attentive to always getting paper out of what I was working on, whether I was going to stay in that area or not. That might have been one of the things that I would have, you know, because sometimes you do 80% of the work and then you don't write it up, you know. How many of us talk about all those papers in the drawer? I would probably do that. If that was one thing I would do, that's probably what I would do differently. And then I probably wouldn't, you guys are so good with this, I wouldn't have taken myself quite so seriously.
I can agree, probably, definitely with the writing part. And as my colleague was talking about, you know, how we, you know, community advocates, community work. Well, I'm a very big community person. I'm very passionate about that. And I can remember my dissertation chair saying, you know, Priscilla, just get your PhD, then you can save the world. And so I had to go through that. So, and then doing a postdoc, though I was at a very research intense at Hopkins, at Johns Hopkins doing my postdoc, a two-year postdoc there, but still I was so engaged in the community part because I did a community health postdoc fellowship. So our whole goal was to make sure we were partnering with the community in the work that we do. And I said all this to say, transition into academia, because from my postdoc I did go into academia and into a PhD public health program teaching. And so finding the balance between the research part, even though my research was with community, but kind of drawing the line because I was so engaged and I stayed on the East Coast in the Maryland area. And so my community partners were still wanting time from me as though I was still just doing the postdoc 100%. But even out of that, still getting the papers, because even after teaching and the work that's being done, and I was determined, because it's like, okay, then I have other obligations outside, then something would go lacking. And it's probably on the publication side of more of the things I probably, more of the things I probably would have gotten, probably more publications, possibly. I was very careful, because being in a research-driven institution, I also wanted to make sure that I wasn't one of those persons in the brick and mortar, and my whole mindset was, I've got to get publications, I've got to get tenure. And, you know, when I can't do the community part of what I've committed to do in the research, then, oh, well, I was determined not to be one of those persons. So I think you kind of have to go with your gut as well with that, you know, and my colleagues may, you know, voice differently on that, but I wanted to make sure not only being true to myself but to my community partners and the people that I was doing research with.
Could I just sort of say something in relation to that? So I have a different career trajectory in many ways than my colleagues up here. I actually, and like what you said, Dr. Hudson, I'm a political science PhD, and my work has been policy research and analysis. And so I ran a gay rights think tank for 8 years at the National. It was a community-based research institute at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and then I worked on HIV policy with gay men's health crisis for 4.5 years, and then I came to work at the Fenway Institute about a year ago. And so quite often what we would do is put out like a policy brief or kind of a monograph that was aimed at really having an impact on public policy, whether it was repealing the HIV entry ban that was, in our view, undermining public health, particularly as it relates to immigrants at risk for HIV or living with HIV, or trying to get the federal government to do more to address the needs of LGBT elders. So we would put out a brief, but then I think how I would echo my colleagues up here is to say it's really critical to publish academically. So we would put out something and get it to all these government agencies, but then I would take the language and repackage it and submit it to peer-reviewed journal and try to get it published, because what I found is that the policy briefs that we put out, because they were put out by a gay rights group or Gay Men's Health Crisis, which is a HIV services but also an advocacy group, it wasn't considered as objective and as scientifically rigorous. So then to get it through a peer-reviewed into a book or particularly a journal really gave it more shelf life, and it really was cited more often, more likely to be cited, and really had an impact on the literature, got used in classes and gets, you know, taught in classes more. So I think that's really critical. And like, I have a book that just got published in April or May that, honestly, my co-author and I wrote it several years ago, and then we kept updating it. And it took forever with this university press, but it finally got published, and now it's out there. And I actually got invited to write a piece for AJPH because of that book. So I would just encourage you to be tenacious and really, even though, you know, you're not necessarily going to see the benefits immediately, a couple years down the line, that article will finally get through your fourth round of edits and into AJPH, and it'll be a great feeling.
Could I add to that a little bit? I really appreciate what you're saying, and I really agree with that. The other flip to that that we built into one of the research and training centers that we were running for a while is that anybody, and we would fund a number of different studies through a research consortium, and the purpose was to get out the academic papers, but then we had the requirement that that particular paper, every paper, would also come out as a consumer piece and or a policy piece. So really wanting to do this, continuing to make the work relevant and asking the author themselves then to make that relevant to different audiences. So I really like that notion.
And if you can actually publish, even as a master's student, working with my mentor and some of the other scientists during that time, if you're fortunate, if you're able to connect with a mentor or with, you know, someone in your department where while you're actually pursuing your studies that you can be a part, that you can actually get a publication during that time, I think that is something awesome, and it will speak volumes as you move forth, especially if you're at the master's level and you're looking or thinking about pursuing, you know, a doctorate degree, and just to have that as a part of your whole application packet to start publishing as soon as you can when you connect. Mm-hmm. That will definitely be a plus for you.
I'll just quickly add before someone else jumps in. Your question is very good in that I'm still trying to calibrate exactly how much effort is equal to good enough. So when you're younger in your academic career, you go with the mindset that everything needs to be perfect or needs to be outstanding. And the fact of the matter is there's only one of you and there's only 24 hours in a day. And so I think that what you were saying is that you have to figure out how to calibrate for each thing, priority level, what is good enough. And I'm still trying to figure that out. What's good enough to get funded? What's good enough to get published? What's good enough to get decent course evals, et cetera, et cetera? And for each one of those things, you have to figure out what's good enough. Because if you try to go for 100% perfection every time, you see paralysis by analysis. So people who never get papers out because they're still running running analysis over and over again. Well, let me look at it this way, that way, this way. And you'll never, so you have to just keep you can't just spin wheels. You have to get stuff out. And eventually you have to let stuff go. And you have to figure out what's good enough. I think that's something that you only gain with experience and time, though, because I'm still trying to find the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. Right. Can I ask a review question? We were hearing a baby out in the hallway a little while ago, and that really just made me think, are many of you struggling with this issue of whether or not to have a family at this point, or does that come up for you? I'm seeing one head nod. We don't have to talk about it. It's not an issue. I just wanted to open that up.
Does it also contain recruitment and clinical trial outcome data?
clinical trial outcome data like HIV clinical trials?
Any clinical trials, and is it also linked to the recruitment of those
trials? I don't know the answer to that. I was pinch hitting for Judy Bradford, who's stuck in Boston because of the weather, and I'm stuck here because of the weather. So I just don't know. But I would encourage you to go to the Femway Health website, femwayhealth.org, and click on Center for Population Studies and LGBT Health, and you can go to the PRISM database and find out. I mean, we are very much involved with a lot of HIV clinical trials, mostly prevention trials. So. Yeah.
Maybe amazing
work, and if I remember correctly, they collect a wealth of really interesting and unpublished data, which would be an ideal project.
Right.
I haven't made where you guys need to go or to shut back.
Were you asking a particular person anything?
And your question is, should you stay though you're done or almost done?
Right. So if you move forward quickly, like within a year.
Okay. I mean, because if you're still moving forward, and you know, you have a date in mind as far as your graduation, because there are postdocs that are out there. I mean, you know, you may have to, you know, search them out, but there's funding, and, you know, depending on your area, not just even with cancer, but there, you know, postdoctoral research, I can speak for NIH just across the board, you know, from behavior science, you know, science to, you know, the basic, you know, science. And so even doing a postdoc, I think that's one of the things where you have an advantage, though, if you're not totally, you know, immersed already, you know, into the field as far as taking a position. But doing a postdoc, I think that is a wonderful opportunity to build as far as publications, connecting. And then, again, it depends on, you know, where you're moving. Are you able to stay within the same, you know, area where you are as far as geographically or connected to those projects, but then have it, though, reflected from the postdoc level. And so if you're actually able to do that, I mean, I got, you know, phenomenal research experience doing my two-year, you know, postdoc and, you know, presentations out of it and different things like that. In fact, I think that's probably the time that I actually wrote, I started writing the paper from my dissertation that got published, but it was during the time, you know, having a postdoc, because then I didn't have to teach. And some postdocs you may have to, but I didn't have to teach during that time, so I could focus on, you know, writing and conducting my research and working to get publications and doing presentations, going to conferences and different things like that.
I think some of it will depend on where you are in your own sense of urgency. If you feel like you are done with the program and you're ready for some, you really want to move, then that's probably a good thing to know. And if you've been there for a long time and you're not moving, then maybe staying is also such a good thing. But often a move will disrupt you, whether it's a move to a postdoc and somebody will have expectations for how you spend your time there, or if it's your first position, there will be lots of expectations for what you do. So if you've got some things that are in process and you think you could really finish some things up, wrap some things up in an extra year, and there's no other pressure that says I've got to keep moving, it really might work well for you. I agree with you that postdocs are a great opportunity, and really see people who have come through a postdoc and presenting in a more polished kind of way as well.
So there's just a number of things to think about, probably, how to put that together.
Yeah, I would just say in my gut, I don't think it's ever a good idea to stay back. I think that you can, if you're creative and productive, you can publish while you're doing your postdoc. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to not move forward. I think mm-hmm. it's just a good idea.
Yeah, I would say it depends on what you want to do. So if you know you want to stay in the academy, then what type of school do you want to be at? Mm-hmm. And do you have the thing, so if you're going to a research one, do you have publications either in the pipeline, or are you planning on doing a postdoc, or you're going to go straight to the faculty market? It really depends on what you want to do. I left graduate school kicking and screaming, though. So I finished quickly, and I was like, wow, I'm out here. But I think when you put your stuff together, people can look at your CV and tell where you're at, and they're hiring you for your potential. So I think some people will think, oh, I need to have a gazillion publications and a K award, et cetera, to be competitive. But what you really need is a really good idea and be able to express the idea and show that your previous work links to the exploration of the idea. I think that's more important than just the numbers game that people think about.
Your advocacy, your passion comes out by what you choose as your topic. And then you really do need to be true to science. If what you want is to have findings that will hold up under scrutiny. But clearly you need to have a real investment in an area of work, and I think that's where our passion and our advocacy comes from. But then I think you do have to be rigorous. As rigorous as you can be. And that's not to say that the research questions you have to settle on are ones that can be rigorously researched, because I think some of the issues that are most interesting may have small ends, or it's harder, you know, methodology isn't as developed, but you've got to do the best that can be done for the field at that time. That's my personal view.
Yeah. As you were talking, it reminded me of something that my chair said when I was writing up my findings and results for my dissertation, and I remember him stating, he's like, you know, Priscilla, you know, keep it simple, you know, just write, report what the data stated. And so in that, and because it was something very passionate, because I looked at breast cancer screening, developed the first program for the East Tennessee region, and in developing that, then measuring the effectiveness of that in increasing screening among women of color. And so very passionate for so many reasons on that, but being true to it and making sure scientific rigor was there, and not being biased, but to write up, you know, what the data said. And so when you asked that question, I thought about, you know, how do you avoid getting so immersed into the community work of that you're so exhausted, you know, the scientific part or the responsibilities that come along with being in the academy run short. And you do have to be careful and balance your time. I think, as we've heard around the table, you know, it's a learning game. You learn, and then after you go through and figure out, I spent way too much time out in the community. That's a lesson learned. That's a paper all by itself. And then you readjust in different things like that. But I think one of the things I remember in choosing my topic and some advice I was given was, you know, something that you have some passion about, because you're going to be married to this thing, you know, for a while. So I would encourage, you know, you to think about that as well, though you have the tendency, you know, to have to make sure you don't get overwhelmed and so immersed in it. But then something that you do have a passion about, because even if you change after you get through that dissertation, from the time you start that process of your PhD until you're married, parent to that baby until, you know, and then some, and I chose to stay the course and continue to do research in that area, but, you know, so it is. It's lessons learned, I think, along the way.
I would just echo what the other panelists say. I think you have to be objective at all times. It's hard when it's something that you're personally invested in. It comes out when you're explaining what's going on in your discussion sections or your recommendation sections and things like that. But you stick to what the data say. So it's been plenty of times that I'll run analyses that don't support my hypotheses. But I feel like when I report things that don't support my hypotheses, that's how science works. And unfortunately, there's a bias in science to only publish things that have a significant result. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the number of papers that you can't replicate any time looking at their methods and matching their results, I think there is a bias to make things look a certain way. But I think for the good of the field and for the people that we're trying to help out, we owe it to ourselves and to the field to be objective and to be true to what we're trying to do.
I think it's a really important question, and particularly when you're talking about LGBT-related research, it's a real balancing act, because on the one hand, it's a wide-open field where there's very little research on the population and on the issues affecting the population. So I think you really, it's important to do the research, but also just be really upfront about your methods and try to be as objective as you can. But, I mean, I'm just thinking of an analysis that we did in 2004-05 at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, where we were generally interested in looking at the census data on same-sex couple households and understanding what were the race and gender differences. So in other words, how were lesbian couples different from gay male couples, and how were black and Latino couples different from white non-Hispanic couples in terms of income, home ownership, parenting rates, et cetera. And so it was interesting objectively from a kind of social science demography perspective, but it was also really relevant because the anti-gay movement was basically has been doing this since the 1980s, portraying equal rights for gay people as a threat to the civil rights of people of color, and portraying civil rights as a zero-sum game or as a limited pie. And what the census data showed actually that the people that had the most at stake in fights over family recognition were lesbian couples, particularly black and Latino lesbian couples, because they were more likely to have kids. They were lower income, partly because women are lower income compared to men, but definitely compared to like white gay and lesbian couples were lower income, and they were more likely to rent than own, less likely to own their home. And the African Americans were more likely to have public sector jobs than other gay people of other races, and that's true of African Americans in general. And so all these anti-gay family ballot questions, like in Michigan and Ohio and Georgia and elsewhere, were not only striking down or banning marriage, but they were banning domestic partner health benefits for public sector workers, and that was disproportionately hurting African Americans in the lesbian gay community. So you know, so there's political uses to the research, but the research has to be in and of itself very grounded, and the methodology has to be very strong, or else people aren't going to take it seriously.